Grant Taff last month retired as the executive director of the American Football Coaches Association. He was a legendary coach for Baylor University in West Texas, and over his tenure there as the coach, compiled a very, very big record in terms of wins and that type of thing. But he also was the type of person that inspired a great deal of loyalty among his team and his staff. Baylor won their first conference in 50 years, their first championship, the third year he was there. The first 2 years, they didn't have many wins because he was in the process of building and establishing a solid foundation and structure for everything. So they didn't do too well for those first 2 years. Just prior to the third season, the assistant coach approached him and said, "You know, coach, one of our supporters, a person that's really enthused about Baylor and what we're doing here, is a farmer out in West Texas, and he's invited us out to go hunting on his property." And so they thought about it, and they thought, well, this will be a good opportunity to get out before we start the 14 to 16 hour days that happen once you start training for the football team. They're long, hard, arduous days in the hot Texas sun. So they decided they would take him up on it. They put their guns in their pickup truck and departed. Upon arriving at the farm, the coach said, "Why don't you stay here? I'm going to go up and tell him that we're here and that we'll be hunting and to thank him for inviting us." Well, as the coach knocked on the door, he couldn't believe the enthusiastic greeting that he got. "Coach, man, it is so good to see you," he said. "You're doing a great job with your Baylor Bears. You know, I know you haven't won a lot of games the first two seasons, but I believe that this year is really going to be a championship season." Well, the coach was both pleased and a little humbled by this outburst of gratitude, but he said, "Well, thank you very much." He said, "And thank you for letting us hunt here. And if there's anything that we can ever do for you, please let us know." "Well, coach, there is one thing you could do for me. Do you see that mule that's parked out in front of your pickup about 50 yards? That mule has been with us for the last 20 years, and it's just like a member of the family. But recently, it's contracted a disease that can't be cured. And he should, or, you know, be put out of her misery. I should say her, put out of her misery. But I can't bring myself to do it because I'm so close to her. My wife can't fire a rifle, and she wouldn't step on an ant even. So would you do the job of putting her out of her misery for us?" Well, the coach thought, "As long as we're here, sure, we can do that." And on his way back to the truck, he got an idea, which, as he said later, is pretty bad for a football coach. But anyway, he scowled and screwed his face up into a real grimacing type of appearance and bit his tongue until there was a tear coming down his eye. And he got back to the truck, and the assistant coach said to him, "Coach, what's wrong?" And he said, "That old farmer just infuriated me. He told me that he couldn't believe that we were still there and that Baylor wasn't going to win another game this season while you and I were here." "What?" was the incredulous reply. The assistant coach said, Not only that, he said that we probably are going to have the worst, or we probably have the worst coaching staff in the history of football. Not only did he say that, but he also said that if we didn't get off this farm immediately, he was going to sic the law on us. I can't believe it, the assistant coach said. After all, he had invited us to shoot and go hunting here. I know, the coach said, it makes me so mad the more I think about it. As a matter of fact, I know what I'm going to do. You see that mule out there? I'm going to shoot his mule. So he grabs the rifle off the back of the truck, and the assistant coach trying to calm him down. He said, you know, trouble or not, the coach says, I'm tired of people bad-mouthing, you know, Baylor. Trying to hide his ever-widening grin, he took the gun out, leveled it, squeezed the trigger, bang, and put the mule out of his misery. As he turned over to see what the assistant's coach response or reaction to that, he heard two other bang, bang on the other side of the car or the truck, and the coach said, I just shot two of his cows, now let's get out of here. Now, obviously, had this happened, it was a legend kind of circulating around the campuses, things like that do. That would be what you call taking loyalty just a little bit too far. Well, how loyal are you? How loyal am I? You know, the word loyalty doesn't appear anywhere in the King James version of the Bible. But an excellent synonym for that does, and that is the word faithful. Let's look at an example. Let's look at an example of someone that was very faithful. Turn to Genesis 22, beginning in verse 1. Genesis 22, verse 1. And this is going to cover the account of Abraham, and it's well known. But beginning in verse 1, it said, and it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, I'm here, boss. Behold, here I am. Verse 2, and he said, take now thy son, thy only son, Isaac. And you remember that Sarah was barren until she was 90, and Abraham was almost 100 before she had a child. It was their first child together. Take now thy son, thy only son, Isaac, the one that you've looked forward to having, between the union between the two of you, that the one that you take out with you all the time to go hunting, the boy that you look at as the apple of your eye, whom you love, and get thee into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee. Very peculiar, a very strange request. Going on to verse 3, but notice something about what happens. And Abraham rose up early in the morning. He didn't say, you know, can we talk this over? Can we go down to the, you know, corner Starbucks or whatever the name would have been back then and get a warm glass of camel's milk and talk about this. I mean, this is a very strange thing after you know how long we've waited to have this child, and you're telling me that I'm to take him up and kill him? But he didn't do that. He got up early. He didn't delay. He didn't put off. God told him to do something, and he responded. Got up early in the morning and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and chopped the wood for the burnt offering and went unto the place of which God had told him. Well, that didn't all happen within the period of a few hours, because as we'll see a little further, it took him 3 days to travel from his home to where Mount Moriah was. During this trip with his son, what do you think was going on? What was he thinking about? What was running through his mind? You know, did he only pack enough food for a trip for four going one way, but only three coming back? Or maybe if Sarah was preparing the food, and I'm sure she didn't know what was going on because she'd been out there screaming at him and not letting him take her only son. She would have had that kind of response, I'm sure. But in order to have everything appear to be normal, she probably, if he told her to pack the lunch, she'd, you know, pack it for four going and enough for us to return. Because he didn't want to create any suspicion, especially for Isaac. If Isaac knew he was somehow involved in this, he would have had a totally different outlook on the trip itself. So that didn't happen. He got up early. He went about getting ready. He got on the donkeys and they took off. Then, verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his two young men, stay here with the animals and we will go and worship and return. He didn't say, I'm the only one that's coming back. He said, we will return. Verse 6, and Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac, his son. You know, Isaac was a pretty strong young man. And Abraham, he was 100, or crowding 100, I don't remember exactly, but close to 100. And he didn't exactly have a lot of stamina, even though back at that point in time, they probably ate a great deal differently than we do and was probably, you know, a lot more healthy than a 100-year-old person would be now. But in any event, maybe he said, well, if I tire him out, it'll be a lot easier when we get to the top of the mountain. And I don't know if that was going through his mind or not, but it just made sense. He was young. He had the physique. He had the physical strength. So Abraham took the wood, put it on him, and then he took the fire and a knife. Verse 6, and they went, both of them, together. You know, as they hiked up that mountain, did Abraham stop every so often to ostensibly catch his breath or rest so he could prolong the inevitable moment when he had to kill his son? Did he delay at this point of time? Did he think, well, maybe God's going to do something and he's going to change his mind, he's going to change his plans? But nothing like that happened. Or conversely, did he say, I got to get up there and get it over with? So he went as fast as he could, and Isaac's got this load of wood, and he said, Dad, will you slow down and let me catch my breath? You're wearing me out. We don't know. If you think about what you might do in a similar situation, how you might delay something, that might be a way of doing it, or speeding it up, conversely. Verse 7, Isaac spoke unto Abraham his father, and he said, my father. And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, you've got the fire, I've got the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" Verse 8, "And Abraham said, 'My son, God will provide a lamb for a burnt offering.' So they went both of them together." I think we might notice that. I doubt if any of you will ever be faced with a similar situation. Not since the death of Jesus Christ. I don't think there's been any recorded account of where God has told someone to kill his son. This was a once kind of in a lifetime event. But it does tell you that he knew that God was going to provide. It didn't go into any kind of detail at all, but he had his trust and his faith in God. In verse 9, they came to the place which God had told him of, and Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And if you think about that, what about these last moments? I mean, we read this story and we read it like a novel. It's an event. You go by it 8 or 10 sentences and you can read it in 3 or 4 minutes. But do you think about the time, and do you think about what's going on in Abraham's mind and what's not written here? You know, how did he talk Isaac into getting up on that wood and lying there prone? You know, how do you tell your son something like that? How did he talk to him? Or did he have to restrain him? Did Isaac at the last minute realize what was happening? And he was stunned. It was totally beyond him. He couldn't believe it, what his dad was doing. Could he just lie there? Or as a strong lad at that age, did he try to fight for his life? Did that primal instinct of survival kick in at the last minute when he realized what was going on? And did he resist and fight back? I mean, if you think of yourself in a situation like that, or if you were being attacked, what would your normal reaction be when something comes at you out of nowhere and you're not prepared, you're not expecting it? Or did he just submit? What was Abraham thinking? Had he ever killed anyone? In Genesis 14, there's an account, and the only one, as far as I could see in researching it, that he went after the people that had taken Lot, his brother. And it said, the only verse, it says he and the company with him smote that group and rescued Lot. But that's the only specific instance I could see of where he may have killed someone. But absent that, you know, Abraham wasn't trained in the art of warfare. Although he'd probably killed many sheep over his lifetime and other animals for food. But how do you kill a person painlessly and quickly? I mean, that's an art. You see the Navy SEALs or the commandos or the Rangers on TV where they come up behind someone and put their arm around his neck and slit their throat. I mean, it looks effortlessly. They're trained. They've had hours and days of training like this. That's the enemy. You don't think a thing about it. It's a normal reaction, and it's over. But this, your son that you've waited years and years for, is it that easy? And if you see pictures that are painted of this specific time in the Bible, you usually see a picture of Abraham with a knife up like this, getting ready to plunge it into his son who's bound on the altar. You know, was he holding the knife up to strike? If he was, what did he intend to do? You know, if you cut a person's throat and their jugular vein, it's not long before they're gone. But when you hit someone, depending upon where you hit them, maybe one stroke doesn't do it, and he has to do two or three. Can you picture that in your mind, doing that to someone that you loved? And what would be going through your mind as he was holding the knife up to strike? The other thing is, did Isaac sense on this journey, this painful step-by-step journey for Abraham, at least insofar as the last part of it when they were ascending the mountain, his dad was a little different. He was a little more subdued. He didn't respond as quickly as he normally would do. They didn't have the good-natured banter that they usually had. And Isaac was expecting this to be a real outing with his dad, a time they could bond, the time when Sarah wasn't yelling at him to go pick up his clothes. Abraham was thinking, I don't have to listen to her talk about her arthritis. So, you know, father and son together on a trip out in the wilderness, a time to bond, a time to be together, a time where he can only focus on each other. Or did he act as normal as he could because he didn't want to give his son the wrong impression that something was not right? You don't know. But if you think about all the emotions that you go through or could go through, and how you would react in a situation like that, it's something you have to think about. Verse 10, and Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And verse 11, and the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, here I am. And then Abraham finally realizes the reason why God gave him this test. Verse 12, and he said, lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know without a shadow of the doubt you've proved to me that you fear me. And the reason I know is you haven't withheld your son, your only son, from me. Of all the things you have and all the things you could have tried to barter with, your property, your other children by Sarah's handmaids, or whatever, you didn't do that. You just obeyed my command, and you were getting ready to slay your son. Verse 13, and Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went, took the ram, and offered him for a burnt offering instead of his son. You know, as Christians sitting here this afternoon on warm, comfortable seats in this hall, will the time come for some of us who will be faced with something like this, and maybe not the same thing, but where we ourselves are the ones that may be what has to be offered in order to substantiate what we believe and prove we're serious about what we believe. You know, we may dismiss what's happening in the Middle East. We hear these reports. We sit here in the comfortable chairs, soft cushion, like almost like a movie theater, and think, well, that's going on. That's way over there. You know, there'll be plenty of people over there that may have to suffer, have suffered, are suffering. But, you know, God's protecting us. And we're kind of immune to that. And that's true. That's certainly very true. But at some point, will someone have to prove their loyalty to God by giving up their own life? Or are the martyrs only going to be in the Middle East? I don't know if we can count on that. Well, God knew that Abraham would likely, or knew what he likely would choose. He was hoping he would choose the way he did. Still, he allowed him to make the choice of whether to obey him, to make the choice of whether he would do what God had requested, or whether he would consider his son more important and choose his son, showing that he loved his son more than he loved God. Many years later, our father would have to make a similar choice to allow his only son to die so that our sins could be forgiven. And in a sense, the choice was allow him to die or just turn your back on humanity and not allow there to be a Savior, not allow it to happen. Well, you know the choice, and we can be very thankful for the choice that God made. Turn to Romans 4. I'm going to be reading a few verses out of the NLT. Romans 4, starting in verse 19. Abraham's faith did not weaken, even though at about 100 years of age he figured his body was as good as dead, and so was Sarah's womb. They were both past the age where they usually, in most cases, were capable of having offspring. Abraham never wavered in believing God's promise. Verse 20, in fact, his faith grew stronger, and in this he brought glory to God. Verse 22, and because of Abraham's faith, God counted him as righteous. Verse 23, and when God counted him as righteous, it wasn't just for Abraham's benefit. It was recorded for our benefit too, assuring us that God will also count us as righteous if we believe in him, the one who raised Jesus, our Lord, from the dead. A very important scripture. You know, when you think about it, Jesus' sacrifice is the starting point for salvation and the foundation of all of the annual festival days throughout the year that follow. The Passover, that is the beginning. Turn to Mark 14. Mark 14, starting in verse 31. And this is the account of where Jesus told Peter that he was going to deny him. But he, Peter, spoke more vehemently, "If I should die with thee, I will not deny thee in any wise." He was very strong and emphatic about this. And there's a verse right after this that we probably don't look at that closely because we're so focused on Peter's example. And it's been repeated so often. And those of us who attended Sunday school or the Sabbath school when we were younger, we've heard this example repeated and recited and from the pulpit as well. So it's all focused on Peter. But the next sentence says, "Likewise also said they all." And I think sometimes we tend to either overlook it, go right by it. The disciples all affirmed what Peter said. They said, "We'll stand by you. We've got your back. We'll help you out. If you need help, we're going to be here. We're not going to run out on you." The whole group, as groups and as crowds sometimes do, they get carried away at the moment. And they say and do things that they're not responsible for. Just like all of us sitting here today with people of like minds can say things among ourselves and say, "Well, I'd do this or I won't do this." And you get out where you're isolated and you're in another group with people who are not like you or not like us, of like minds. And you may have a totally different view and you may do things in a very different manner. Verse 32, "And they came to Gethsemane, and he told them, 'Sit here while I shall pray.' And he took Peter, James, and John and began to be sore amazed, very, very troubled, and to be very heavy. After all, he knew what was ahead of him, and this was weighing on his mind, and he wanted the support of the disciples, the people that had been around him, that he'd talked for 3.5 years. If you think when you went to high school, you were in high school for 4 years, usually. And then if you went to college, you were in college for 4 years, unless you went on to graduate school. And say you just did the average thing of 9 months with a summer off. That's 36 months, 3.5 years separated by the summer vacations. But the people that you meet and rub shoulders with and do things with in high school and college can affect the rest of your lives. You become very close. You make close friendships in either one of these situations. It could be in the service as well. This was what Christ hopefully was going to receive from Peter, James, and John. Because he was heavy, because he didn't want to face what was going to happen all alone. And they said, "We'll be there for you. We're right here. We're not going anywhere." Verse 34, "And he said unto them, 'My soul is exceedingly sorrowful unto death. Tarry you here and watch.' And he went forward a little and kneeled down," or lowered himself gently to the ground. No, that's not what it says. It said he fell on the ground. And that ground was probably pretty unyielding, even if it was grassy. But it was desperation. Because it said he prayed, "If it were possible, the hour might pass from him." And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this cup from me, nevertheless, not what I will, but what thou will." So Christ realized how serious this was, how important this was, what a pivotal point in history this was going to be. And yet he was asking, isn't there a way we can, can't we rethink the plan in some way? There's got to be maybe a different alternative. Well, he didn't go through a lot of reasoning. He just said, you know, take away this cup if it's at all possible. But absent that, whatever your will is, that's what's going to happen. And then he came and he found his disciples asleep in verse 37. And then he came a third time in verse 41. I'm just skipping some of it because you know the dialogue. And he said, well, go ahead and sleep. Take your rest. It's enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is betrayed unto the hands of sinners. Rise up, let us go. Lo, he that betrayeth me is at hand. And then the next verses talk about Judas coming and kissing him to identify him, the one who had betrayed him. And verse 50, and they all forsook him and fled. All of his disciples that earlier said, yeah, we'll stand by you. We've got your back. We got your six. They, all of them, and I said 11 because Judas had gone over the other side, all forsook him and fled. Verse 53, and they led Jesus away to the high priest. With him were assembled all the chief priests, elders, and scribes. And they go through the process of trying to find a way of incriminating him. In verse 56, it said, for many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. He couldn't find two people to corroborate what these things were that he was supposedly to have committed. But finally in verse 63, the high priest finally rent his clothes and said, well, we don't have any need for any further witnesses. You've heard the blasphemy. What think you? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And then verse 65, some began to spit on him, to cover his face, buffet him, say unto him, facetiously prophesy. You know, who is this that's doing this? And the servants did strike him as well with the palms of their hand. And then you go through, and we're not going to spend any time because you know the story of where Peter actually did do just what Christ told him he was going to do. Before the cock crowed the second time, he'd had denied him three times. Turn to Mark 15. So they continued this process of interrogation, and they took him before Pilate, and Pilate asked him a number of questions. But verse 5, but Jesus yet answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. You know, how can he, in spite of everything, not even try to defend himself? In verse 12, and Pilate answered and said unto him, or unto them, what will you then that I shall do unto him whom you call the King of the Jews? And that was where he was given a choice of releasing someone back, giving them freedom, which in turned out to be Barabbas. And the other person, he said, or the other person was killed. And so Pilate, in verse 15, willing to content the people because they'd made such a big furor and uproar, released Barabbas unto them and delivered Jesus when he had scourged him to be crucified. And I'm not going to go through that. You've heard very graphic descriptions of this over the years, and that's not my intent to spend time on that. Verse 17, they clothed him with purple and platted a crown of thorns and put it about his head. and began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." So they mocked him. They made fun of him. They did spit upon him, verse 19, and bowing their knees, worshiped him, which of course they were doing it in mockery. They weren't really worshiping him. And verse 20, and when they had mocked him, they took off the purple from him and put his own clothes on him and led him out to crucify him. In verse 22, they bring him unto the place Golgotha, which is being interpreted the place of a skull. And they gave him to drink wine mingled with myrrh, but he didn't have anything to do with it. And when they had crucified him, they parted his garments, casting lots upon them, whatever man should take. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But God had turned his back. He had to at this time. He had to turn a deaf ear to what Jesus was going through. What would you do if it were your son? We have to think about it in that context. Verse 37, finally, and Jesus cried with a loud voice and died. He was done with his part of the plan. He had done as his father asked, just like Abraham has done what his father asked. And now it was up to his father to see him through. It was totally out of his hands. He had been loyal and faithful to his father to the end. His part was ended. But we all know the joyful resurrection that have given us what we have today. Well, we don't need to shoot cows to prove our loyalty, but we do need to be loyal and faithful to God and his son, Jesus Christ. Passover, especially, is a time to always remember this and never, ever forget it.